Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial, now in paperback, David Lipsky explores how anti-science became popular in American life. He outlines the history of climate denial and its consequences. Climate change has become an unavoidable fact and an ongoing catastrophe, and science was clear decades ago. So how did so many Americans come to doubt evidence so widely accepted and compelling? David Lipsky is New York Times bestselling author of the memoir, Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, on which the award-winning film The End of the Tour was based. He's also author of the New York Times bestseller, Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. We'll talk with David Lipsky following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and Science Denial, now in paperback, David Lipsky explores how anti-science became popular in American life. He outlines the history of climate denial and its consequences. Climate change has become an unavoidable fact, an ongoing catastrophe. Science was clear decades ago. So how did so many Americans come to doubt evidence so widely accepted and compelling? It's a central theme of the book. David Lipsky is a New York Times bestselling author of the memoir, Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace, on which the award-winning film The End of the Tour was based. In the film, Lipsky was played by Jesse Eisenberg. Just to throw that in there. Lipsky is also author of the New York Times bestseller, Absolutely American, 4 Years at West Point. David Lipsky, it's such a pleasure to welcome you to Access Utah. Thank you.
Tom, it's great to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So how did you come to write this book?
Part of it actually is an answer. So when I talk to people about the book, one of the things that they do, which makes the publisher happy, is they read the jacket copy, which I wrote. So the jacket copy, if it ever seems like praising and you wonder if it made the writer blush, you can know that it's just what the writer has always wanted said about herself, because they, often people, new hires at the publisher will write it, and then the writer will think that she's not going to step in, but then she ends up, I've never known anybody who didn't end up writing their own copy. And I really, every time I hear the copy for this book, I wince, because it sounds official, like we should take this material and we should solemnly absorb it. And it really isn't the reason that I did the book. And it wasn't the tone. It's one of those things where however cool you want to be on a date, or however you want this Thanksgiving or this Christmas to be different, it rolls around and you put on your holiday sweater and you serve the same things you've always served. So the reason I did the book was I learned something that was, well, two reasons, but I'll just do the official one first. I learned that we had known everything we know about climate, that basically you get in your car or you drive, or you have the pleasure of cable TV or Wi-Fi or talking to Tom. I'm looking at a pane of glass, and he, I assume, is looking at a pane of glass on a piece of metal with buttons arranged on it in the shape of a typewriter keyboard. And because of electricity, he and I are communicating. Now, that's great. And the cost for that is that we pollute the temperature in the future. Now, that seemed like it came late. And so who could have done anything about it? Like, we only found out 15 or 20 or 30 years ago. But I was doing another project, and I saw that we had known since the 50s, and at a presidential level, we had known since the 70s. And that was a tremendous surprise to me, and I thought that it was a great story, but it was also just anger. Do you know, Tom, do you know the writer Elizabeth Hardwick?
I don't, no.
Do you know that? Okay, so do you know the poet Robert Lowell?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's funny because I don't know if you follow this sort of thing, but he was like a giant figure. It's a little bit like if you go back and you watch old movies and you're like, why did people get excited about Judy Holliday? Like, that name sounds like it's a old-time movie name. And then you go back and you try to reconstruct whatever the world was that made her a film star. Same thing with Robert Lowell, who every like he was a central figure in the culture in the 50s and 60s. That was Elizabeth Hardwick's husband. And now people don't read him. It's weird. It would be like if 20 or 30 years from now, people are puzzling on Access Utah over Sally Rooney. Anyway, Elizabeth Hardwick is his wife and, to my eye, a better writer than Lowell. And she said a great thing, that there are only two good reasons to write. Can you guess what they are, Tom?
I'm guessing from this book, outrage. Maybe
that is okay. Yeah, Tom, are you a card player? That's well done. What Hardwick said is the only two good reasons to write were revenge and money.
Okay, yeah.
Like
yeah.
if you write mm-hmm. that those were otherwise they're not good reasons to write. And then Samuel Johnson, who was one of the first professional writers in English, he narrowed it down to one, which is only a fool and a blockhead. He said, didn't write for money. I'm the fool and the blockhead. In my case, it was all the anger stuff. I just couldn't believe that people would act like they were serious about this issue when we had known about it for 70 years.
Hmm. You said you wanted a different subtitle. Well, no subtitle at all, I think you yeah. said, but The Parrot and the Igloo could suffice. But American climate is what you wanted. Why that?
Well, for two reasons. One is it's about the climate in America. But the second thing is it is about the world that we live in. Like this, this is the money side of the revenge and money. It was clearly a great story because it's like a disaster movie, but it's real. But the second thing is you had all these, the way movies like Titanic or the Poseidon Adventure to go from the Memorial Day and Labor Day of boats having trouble at sea movies that had a great cast and they were, they represented every part of America, scientists, reporters, people looking up and wondering why it's so hot, politicians, university teachers. It was like all of America was in this story. And so you could read about our climate, our four seasons and the weather, and you could also get a sense of what it is to be an American now. It was a thrilling story for that reason. It was like, do you know how like Canterbury Tales gives you an idea of what that world was like?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, this gives you an idea of what our world is like. Mm-hmm. It's a chowder with every vegetable and meat in the broth.
Yeah. You obviously wanted to be fun, chapter titles are clever and fun. You say in the preface you want this to be, people to binge this like a Netflix series. Even though it's a serious story, you want people to be able to, I guess, digest it. you could go
Tom,
deep.
Yeah, but Tom, it goes, so the it's been interesting reading the reviews because I've been doing press about this for a year. And so you do a lot of conversations and then some reviews will straggle in. The main reviews will come in. So like the Times, which is a wonderful paper that I've written for and that we all grow up reading, they said the thing that you would want them to say if you worked as hard as I did, which is that it was top flight climate literature mm-hmm. and it was also cliffhanger entertainment. That was the thing that I wanted because it's a story that we should all know because people take advantage when you go to buy a car or when you go to buy a house or if you're divorcing someone who's gotten divorced before, they take advantage of your not knowing stuff. And especially in politics, the people that we vote for, they take advantage of our only knowing the stuff that they tell us. So, I thought this issue, which we're going to have with us for a long time, if I could make this story be one that told you everything you needed to know, that would be sort of an amazing thing to do. But on the other hand, so that was the cliffhanger part, make it into a story. But on the other hand, to make it something that you would know what you needed to know, that's been sort of thrilling to me to get reviews on. So like Rolling Stone calling it essential or Booklist, which is the organ for libraries, saying that this has to be seen as the historical record to date. To do something that would be both a cliffhanger and the essential record to date, that was worth spending all that time on.
I want to spend a lot of time on part three, the deniers, which it has resonance beyond climate. This whole industry of denialism is really taking root. But the first part of your book is inventors, Samuel Morse, Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison. You were at Nikola Tesla. Was very was very prescient. He foresaw that in the future world we'd be doing work by typing on keys, right?
Yeah, he foresaw this. Okay, so fascinating figure. So the book, part of why I thought why in the book it says watch this as a Netflix series is, you know, see it as three different seasons. First season is the inventors, people who made the world that we live in. Second part of the book is the scientists. And from the 1890s and especially from the 1920s, they were like a CSI team. They were like criminal minds with an unsub. Like, what is happening to our weather? There's this theory that carbon dioxide could do it. No one is sure it's true. Let's start trying to prove it. And that's also a great season if it's if you're a CSI fan. And then the last season is the deniers, which is once the scientists have proven this thing and kicked it back to us, what are we going to do? Maybe we're not going to do anything. Maybe that's a cool decision too. They want people to decide a certain way, and they're being paid by people who want us to decide a certain way. And that is the third season. I started with the inventors because A, that's where this situation comes from, but B, what a treat to write about Tesla. Like, Tesla invented the electricity. He invented the way of distributing the electricity that we're using right now to talk and listen. And it should have made him a bundle. He was, the news in the 19th century is very quaintly open and straight-faced. Do you know how your dog is not at all subtle about loving you? That's kind of how media was then. So they would say things about Tesla and Edison. They would say they were the great benefactors of the race. Like, you just don't see, like, Steve Jobs, they'll say he was great, or they'll talk about his marriage, but you never just get a thank you like that from the media. But Tesla was also really a restless figure. And after he had designed the system for distributing electricity, both across landscapes and then into machines like our computers, he got fascinated by the idea that if you use radio waves in a certain way, Tom, you could be where you are and I could be in New York and we could talk to each other, not from a fixed position, but if you went out on the lawn and if I suddenly got on a boat and were at the North Pole. That's the example that he used. And he told the newspapers around the turn of the last century that soon it would be quite easy to communicate from anywhere to the North Pole. Now, what he was, it was like someone had gone back in time and shown him an iPhone and then jumped back into whatever, you know, temporal wormhole brought you there in the first place. He spent the last 30 years of his life working on that and ended up alone in a hotel, you know, with all his money spent. He built a giant radio tower in Long Island, and the hotels he was staying in, he didn't have money to pay them. They knocked it down and sold it for parts. The worst thing that can happen to an inventor, your product is worth more as the parts than as the sum of the parts. So it was great writing about Tesla because it's also any life, which is you have those hot streaks and it says, it makes you say, hey, I'm going to do something even bigger. And then the next shot is you 10 or 15 years older holding an ice pack to your head and there are cartoon birds and bells rolling around in a halo around your crown.
You have said that you during the writing of this book, you were not so great at dinner parties. Your friends have told you that.
Yeah.
Well, I can guess why. Why was that?
Basically, I don't know. Tom, like, do you know, do people in your orbit, do they change what they said? Like, you know that they said, we're going to see Oppenheimer Thursday night. And you're like, great. So you don't see it on Monday or Tuesday. And then you're having dinner and you're waiting for dinner to be over. And the person you're with seems to be teasing it out. And then eventually you say, you said we were going to see Oppenheimer. I've been reading up on him. I'm really excited. And then that person says, I never said that. Do you have that
Yeah,
experience ever?
sometimes,
Yeah,
sometimes,
yeah.
yeah.
And then the question socially is, how much do you remind them? Like, I remember that when I first started working for Rolling Stone, the same people who called my book essential, so I guess you have to take it with a grain of salt. But my boss there told me that I shouldn't tell the owner. If the owner said, "Hey, you need to fly to London to do the story," and I, bought my London hat and was bragging to people, and then I found out that I wasn't going to London, I was going to Hoboken. And I would say to the editor, "I'm going to go in there and say to the owner, he told me he was going to London. Or he told me I was going to London." And my editor said, "Oh, no, you never do that. People hate being told what they said to you. Never do that." If I can pass along one bit of business advice, that is, I teach. And that is the advice that I find myself giving to people for meetings more than any other. Anyway, if dealing with denial and dealing with politicians, you find yourself doing that all the time. And so, since I was doing that when I was at my keyboard, I was doing it in every personal interaction. And it, as you might guess, it made me extremely popular. "Oh, let's invite David. He's the person who's going to tell me that what I'm saying today is totally different from what I said last Thursday."
Let's take a break. When we come back, I want to get into just jump right into the third part, deniers. A lot there, and
Don't skip the scientists. Those guys are great. I'm teasing on the other side of the book.
okay, right. Well, we'll loop back to them. Well, in your preface, you gave me permission to read wherever I, wherever I wanted to jump in, right?
That's great.
So we're talking with the writer David Lipsky. The latest book is The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with David Lipsky about his book, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial. He outlines the history of climate denial and its consequences. Other parts in the book called The Inventors, and there's a part called The Scientists as well. So, David Lipsky, before we jump into the third part, Deniers, the title, I think, indicates this the where we used to be and where we kind of are now in terms of consensus, right? I mean, there's always been a scientific consensus, right? Very, very strong scientific consensus, human-caused global warming. But the public is nowhere near where they used to be.
There's a first off the I don't know if this is how you experience our national life. And the weird thing is, I think it's filtered down to the personal level too. But whenever something becomes an issue, whenever it steps into the great convention hall of American issues, like what do we teach in schools, or how do we deal with guns? Or you don't get, "Okay, here's what's good," or "here's what's bad." You get insane yelling on both sides and simplified yelling positions. And that is like, that's the secret cool part of the title, which is any issue becomes either parrot, warm weather, or igloo, cold weather. And I think what it tells us at home is, oh yeah, the serious thing has become theater, basically. There's a word, do you know a lot of college and graduate students?
Oh, yeah, certainly, yeah.
Okay, there's a word that they've loved for about 7 or 8 years, performative. And it sounds like theater in the round. And so I feel embarrassed because if this was a university audience, it's like, "David, you're using not slang, but you're using a fashionable word from 2015. And now we're going to try to find a different way to say it." But basically, when things become crazily performative, I think we properly understand it's a performance and nothing is likely to happen. So that is the shadow. That's like the cool shadow meaning of parrot and igloo. But the actual story is temperature pollution, global warming. Even those words seem like BS. They've been said so many times. There's a thing that actors know, that if you keep repeating a line, even like the most wrenching line in the world, if you're curious, the most wrenching line I think in the world is King Lear realizes that because of his terrible behavior, his daughter is dead. It's a very simple line. Would you like to know what the line is?
Yes.
"Never never, 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 never. That's the whole line. She's just
Aha.
never going to be able, she's never going to be alive again. Generally, when something becomes performative, it's never sort of as simple as that. It's just this larger terrible fake thing that we then begin to not take seriously. The non-performative, non-shadow version of the title is in 1956, it became clear that what seemed like it was a far-off problem, climate change, global warming. God, those terrible words. Those, in any event, it became clear that it was going to start happening not centuries from now, but it would be hitting us by the 80s or 90s. And the Times covered it. It wasn't in some weird out of the way place. It was in the science section of the Times. And the Times summarized it by saying, you know, when it really kicks in, the formerly Arctic regions will be transformed into tropical jungles with tigers roaming in the underbrush and gaudy parrots squawking from the trees. And then the issue, the idea, entered our national life. And 55 years later, after it had been in the party, talked to all the people, kicked into a closet, found itself in the basement, crawled its way out, taken upstairs, thought something wonderful was going to happen, then turned around and there was no one with it at all, and then wandered back down into the main room. By 2010, a senator who was a denial senator, one of the people who would say this isn't going to happen, there was a big snowfall, February of 2010, and he and his family built an igloo on the Washington Mall. That's the area between all the different Smithsonians. And they put a sign on it saying, honk if you heart global warming. And so it's a great story to tell, but that's what happened with this thing that affects all of us every day, and especially every summer, and will affect everybody that we know. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, they said that if you were born after February 1985, you have never known a colder than average month on this planet. Every month since February of 1985 has been warmer than average. Essentially, what happens, and this is the title, I know it's a longer answer than you might have anticipated, came in as a parrot and left as an igloo.
Yeah, James Inhofe famously brought a snowball onto the Senate floor as well.
Yeah, that was the
there's
sequel. He didn't. He didn't. He didn't have as big a budget. So he, your knowledge of this is great, Tom.
And you know, some of the stuff is buffoonish, but it is shocking how effective this can be. So denialism didn't start with climate, right? Tobacco industry, et cetera, et cetera. A cottage industry. One person you talked to said, with 25 people, 25 people, we can essentially move the needle, and they have. How did they do that?
That's something that I've wondered about a lot. Obviously they were being paid. So the interesting thing is the number that is 25 people, that's something that someone who is supporting the idea that car exhausts, and it's not a complicated idea. Basically, atmosphere is a closed system. So just to imagine, smoking, it's funny that the issue is connected with smoking. Imagine if you have all the windows shut in the first floor of your house and no one's ever going to open the door. And two people come in and they just quietly are smoking cigarettes in a corner round the clock. After 50 years, won't be bad for the first 20 or 30 years. You'll begin to notice it, but get used to it after 40 or 50 years. After 100 years, you will be living in a place that you want to get out of, but you can't leave the door. Not a complicated idea. So what you needed to get were people who would make it seem complex so that people who are making money off of selling the fuels and then politicians who were being supported by those people would have a reason. They would say, well, S. Fred Singer, he's the one who was the most fun to write about, or Dr. Frederick Seitz, who is a former head of the National Academy of Science. They say that we should do more research. So part of what made it effective is that you could argue that the senators, presidents, and CEOs wanted the case made. And so that's why 24 people, by their own count, could carry it off. The 25th is the person who's saying it, so Tom's math is great. I always say two dozen, but it is indeed 25 people. But I would argue that nobody wanted it to be true.
So that, yeah, and so the powerful forces,
No,
money,
but
money,
yeah.
yeah.
No, Tom, you don't want it to be true, and I don't want it to be true. And nobody listening to this broadcast, whether they're folding laundry that was just turned in a good old washing machine, or they're driving somewhere, or they're turning off their iPhone as they get into an elevator, nobody wants this to be true. And that is a fascinating thing about the story, too. Towards the end of the book, the person who wrote the book, since I haven't written the book for 2 years. Do you know, sorry to make this such a good interview, but do you know the Greek philosopher Heraclitus? There are all these Greek writers who we only know because one or two pages from their notebooks ended up being preserved in someone else's notebook. And Heraclitus is a great philosopher who I think only six of his sentences have been preserved, but one of them is so great that he based a whole posthumous career on it. He said, a man never steps in the same river twice. River is different and the man is different. So it's one of those beautiful things that you should get on a t-shirt. This issue has changed and it's been different people stepping into it and the river has changed. But the basic thing is, it is an amazingly great deal. Fossil fuels have given us an amazing deal, and nobody wanted that deal to change. And the deniers, the way we can tell is the deniers, the denial scientists who were really effective and great for about 25 or 30 years, they haven't really existed on a national level. Think about it. Like when you watch CNN or MSNBC, do you see ever a scientist saying maybe it's not going to happen coming on?
No, you don't see that.
But you would have seen that on CNN in 2005 up to about 2010, 2012. They were beaten. And what they were beaten by is the scientist kept saying angrily, if you don't believe me, wait for the weather. If you don't, climate then affects our daily weather. We promise you it's going to, haven't you noticed? And it's going to get to a point we're noticing it because it's 3/4 of a degree. When it gets to 1.25 degrees, 1.5 degrees, you're going to really notice it. The oceans will be warmer longer, and the number of 90 and 100-degree days per summer will be up 10 or 15 or 20%, and you aren't going to like it. By 2015, the you're not going to like this stuff had come true. And the denial scientists stopped making a losing argument, and we haven't done anything differently. And so one of the interesting things that the book leads you to speculate on, did you hear that heavy sigh? Is that the deniers served a social purpose. We could say it's not us, it's these SOB lying scientists who are stopping action. We haven't had them for 10 years. And no one is doing anything. And that is totally useful to think about.
I want to follow up immediately on that. Do you think we'll, I don't know, it's hard to predict, right? Do you think we stay in this paralysis? Do you have hope that we snap out of it?
Well, Tom, how many times have you talked about it with people on this broadcast?
Many times.
Okay, and
Yeah.
so here's the thing I notice. When I talk about it with people, or when I watch people talk about it, if it gets brought up to them, if it's people whose issue it is, they're slick sounding in a way that we don't like. So that what we know is that person is a salesperson. They're a saleswoman or a salesman. Either they're selling their book, the way I'm selling my book here, or they are selling their goodness on the issue. They're selling vote for me. And there's a thing that, so we can hear that fakeness in their voices. But the other thing, which is super interesting, is if you talk to people about this, it's a little bit like you've told them that a relative they've forgotten that they had, like an aunt, a great aunt, or a great uncle, that you're telling them that they are sick, right? That they're ill. And so the person that you're talking to, they try to look appropriately serious, like their face changes. And then their voice drops and it slows down to convince you that they're serious. And then, wonderfully for them, after 2 to 5 minutes, the topic changes and then they're way happier. So that everybody's behavior is that we have agreed not that this is a serious issue, but that we will pretend it's important and that that will be the action that we're going to take. Do you find anything different?
No,
It's funny watching you pause.
That's the way it is. Yeah, that's you've described it, and I guess part of it's that pressure is, like you said earlier, we, in our heart of hearts, we wish it wasn't true, right?
Yeah, but yes, and also here's the other thing that we've noticed, like, and this is why it was a great story, because there are all these people giving their lives, right, their life careers, both to saying, hey, this is going to happen, and it's going to be bad. And then there are people trained practicers of rhetorical and scientific judo who come in and say, ha, I'm going to stop you from making this statement. So there's all this drama happening to get the message, and the message is delivered. And by the time the message is delivered, I think the way people have looked at it is, hey, we're going to roll the dice on this. This is a pretty good deal. But you've our whole lives, we've seen people talking about how bad the federal debt is.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Like, when did you first hear people talking about the federal debt, the deficit? So every year we run a deficit, and then it gets added to the larger federal debt. And everyone gets that same fake sound when the issue comes up. Let me give you a quick history on the debt, because this is the way we as Americans, and maybe it's the best way, maybe it is the modern way of dealing with problems, which is just let them solve themselves. It was fun to take this group photo of all of us on this giant issue. But the debt first became a political issue when Ronald Reagan ran for president in 79. No one had really talked about it before. The debt that year, the accumulated debt, all the money we had borrowed from our future selves, was $650 billion. That's it, not even $1 trillion. Now, by the time Ronald Reagan and George Bush left office, 1992, 12 years later, and $659 billion for 204 years of American governance, a lot of wars, two world-saving wars, building schools, electrifying the whole country, sending out performers who electrified people's ears around the world. Still, 1979, we owed ourselves $659 billion. 12 years later, we owed ourselves $3 trillion. And everyone started getting that solemn sound in their voice and the serious look on their face. We have to solve this issue. We can't keep borrowing money from the future. Future can't negotiate this. We're just saying, hey, we assume it's okay if we take this cash from you. Do you know what the debt is now?
I don't. It's
about 36
huge.
Trillion. It's 36 trillion.
Yeah.
So we add another trillion every 100 days. So it took us 204 years to get two-thirds of the way to $1 trillion. So essentially we live, sorry, this is making me emotional. We live more than those first 204 years every 100 days. By borrowing another $1 trillion, writing ourselves another IOU. And our whole lives, people have competed to look more serious on the issue. And our whole lives, nobody has done anything about it.
Which produces a whole lot of many symptoms that we're seeing now, right?
Well, it's not great. Yeah, well, yeah. The basic problem with it is that we have more of the money that we spend, which could go to fixing roads, making our schools better, taking us to different planets, solving global warming, it has to go to paying the note, paying off the mortgage that we've taken. But the weird thing is that those two things happened at the same time. The first president who was told unequivocally that we were polluting our future temperature was Jimmy Carter in 1979. And in a way, you could argue that what we've been doing with climate is something we got used to with money. We've just been borrowing weather from the future. And since the future can't negotiate for itself, the future keeps, we keep assuming the future is okay with it.
Well, let's take another break. We'll come back with David Lipsky. The book is The Parrot and the Igloo. It's out in paperback now, and we'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with the writer David Lipsky. The book, The Parrot and the Igloo, Climate and the Science of Denial, is out in paperback now. And he outlines the history of climate denial and its consequences in part three of the book. In other parts, he talks about inventors. It goes back to Tesla and Westinghouse and Edison, etc. Second part of the book is scientists. David Lipsky, I'd like to take this cottage industry of denialism, tobacco, in some respects, effects of aspirin, right, auto industry, et cetera, those 25 very effective people. Now that's expanded. What these folks did so very effectively to cast doubt on science, right? And then that's now morphed into many areas of our life, right? We doubt all experts. It kind of leads into, or maybe it's driven by a kind of a nihilism. So I wonder, maybe you could connect those dots and then tell me how we get out of this.
One feels bad to be laughing about nihilism. So here's the thing about that. And I'm watching the clock because this has been so fascinating. I forgot that this can only be a 3-hour interview.
Okay. Right, all right.
Yeah. But I'm going to try to do this in half a minute. Do you remember when we were kids, there was that Keep America Beautiful ad?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's the most famous PSA ad ever recorded. And it is, the person was referred to as an Indian in the ad. So the ad is known as the Crying Indian. That's if you want to search it on Wiki. And a Native American walks through a highway, sees what we've made of America. Someone adds to it by throwing a bag of fast food garbage out of the car. It lands at the Native American's moccasined feet. Camera goes close to him, and there's a single manly tear welling out of one eye and going slowly down his creased, well-earned creased face. And then a voice comes on and it says something that if you grew up then, you never forgot. And that single tear is referred to by media historians, not just as great television, but as the single most famous visibly shed tear in history. It's been seen by the 90s. It had been seen 6 billion times. I think I read an estimate that it's been seen like 12 billion times, maybe. So probably it's one of the most famous strips of video in history. A voice comes on and says, people start pollution, people can stop it. And it turned out that ad was not paid for by environmentalists, but by Pepsi and Coca-Cola and Coors and Budweiser and the companies that make the cans for all those companies, because they didn't want recycling. And the message they were trying to get out, surface message, was pollution's bad. But the other message that they had worked out and were super clever about bringing to us was, we're not going to do anything. It's up to you. People started pollution and people can stop it. You're going to be stopping it. You're not going to be convincing us to recycle or to send people around to pick up the bottles that people are throwing out of their cars at Native Americans. That is the message that everybody has come down to, not just the fuel companies and the car companies who make money off this, both sides, parrot and igloo sides, because their action is difficult on this. They have decided, hey, we're not going to do anything. The choices are too complex. So it's up to you to get a different light bulb or to get a different car or to not take your family on vacation. And to me, part of the interesting, great story here, the great story part is me being a salesperson because I like the book and want you to read it. So that's the message I'm trying to get through here. But to me, the fascinating thing is that the very environmentalists who understood that was a unfair thing to say to people, we're not going to do it, you're going to do it. Over the 50 years since, they have said, okay, you're the ones who are going to solve this much bigger problem yourself. That is how our country changed, and that's how effective people can be on this. And it's always like friends of mine, a good friend of mine who's in the film business, he has to go to Canada to work on a movie. And a friend of his who was more virtuous said, "Hey, I know you're going to be flying home every month to see your family. Maybe you shouldn't do that." And that is the part of this that I think actually makes people who would otherwise be inclined to take action on this issue, I think it makes them bridle. And I think part of it is that they can see the difference between the politicians who aren't making, quote, tough choices on this, and obviously the companies that are continuing to produce this worldwide, and the governments worldwide that are building electrical generating. I just didn't want to say coal plant because it's so boring, but I'll say coal burning power plant. They see them not making a decision, but it comes down to whether you should go on vacation or whether you should fly home from business to see your family. And I think that that is well meant, but it's really a passing the buck, which has made all of us feel maybe there is no buck and F it. I'm going to act as freely as everyone else is acting.
Do you we just have a few minutes here left. Do you end this book now? Your second tour on the book. Now it's out in paperback. Do you come in more hopeful, less hopeful about the
I think
future?
it's hopeful because I think that as long we have gotten very used in this country, boy, anyone who starts a sentence like that, just turn the radio off. We've gotten really good with the benefit of professionals. We've gotten really good at seeing. Used to be you would talk about something, whole family would get around the table. Everyone would contribute their expertise, and then you would take an action. And in the last, I don't know when you would see this happening. To me, it seems somehow around the turn of the century. Now the talk is the action. So it's like, okay, we had a talk about this. That's great. Now we can move on to something a little more cool. As long as we keep doing that, this continues to be bad and it continues to get a little worse. And so to me, the hopeful thing is that people are beginning to understand that in a way. They're beginning to understand that the way that we have dealt with this issue has been fake, in the way we deal with almost every important thing in the issue is performative and not quite real. And when you notice that, that's how you get people, that's how you get a country to actually do stuff. And the way you can see that it's not serious to us is COVID. Now, people will debate whether the quarantines are good or whether they were bad or whether the vaccines were as helpful. Everyone I know who complains about the vaccines also took the vaccines. But that was a serious issue. It became clearly a serious issue by February and March of 2020. And within 2 or 3 weeks, they were saying we shouldn't leave our homes. And not just that, Americans who are always want to act in the public good. That is one of the great things about being an American. You want to help the people next to you, more so than any other country I know. They were like, okay, we can help each other by staying home. We'll stay home. That is a serious thing. We keep being told that this is the most serious issue facing us. And whenever anyone says that, everyone's face gets its fake look and everyone's voice gets its fake serious sound because people keep saying that and no action is taken. So I think the benefit is people beginning to understand that and to also shake off the idea that they are the ones at fault and that the change is going to come from them. Because what the actual Al Gore, this has always been his issue. And the year he won his Oscar and then the year he won his Nobel Prize, that was the year that an astronaut friend of his must have found a very ornate bottle next to a space capsule and had made a wish in Al Gore's favor. But the year Gore won both those prizes for his work about global warming, he was at Davos, which is that ski camp that billionaires have every January in Switzerland. And they amuse themselves by talking about issues of consequence. And Gore, they were talking about the light bulbs thing. And he said, look, it's about changing laws, not about changing your light bulbs. But people keep telling you it's about changing the light bulbs. And I think that's a way that stops people from seeing that this is important.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Much in the book. Fascinating figures as well. We didn't get to talking about the Reverend Sung Young Moon, who plays a part. Read the book. Fred Singer, who you've said in interviews, an opera should be made of his life. So read about him as well. I'll be interested if the opera comes out as well. We've been talking with David Lipsky. The book is The Parrot and the Igloo. It's out in paperback now and available. David Lipsky, thank you so much.
Oh, Tom, I loved it. Invite me back. We'll do those figures too.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. We'll go out as we do with Leo T. and Skywatcher. Thank you.
It's one sky, many cultures. Skywatcher Leo T. As we look up, look around, and get lost in space. If you're lucky enough to get out of the city, a stargazer can see the wonders of the galaxy spread out in front of, in this case, me. This week, I was visiting South Central Utah, and sitting or standing post-campfire, no optical aids but binoculars occasionally to track down another galaxy off the coast of Cassiopeia, following the star trail to find the puffy cloud of the Andromeda Galaxy, a mere 2.5 million light-years from Earth. Looking almost straight above, the swirly Corona Borealis does the loop-de-loop continuing with loops visible in the black sky, faint star trails in the summer triangle, comforting blue-white Vega, star clouds and nebulosity glowing in the southwest in Scorpio, and Sagittarius grabs your imagination and spirit toward the center of the galaxy. Nearby, the next day, Dr. D, the desert mystic, showed me his dark sky hay bale home, which we will discuss in a future episode and maybe go down a river with the desert mystic. Also here are Daoud and Chloe Valentine, archaeoastronomers that have been on Skywatcher Leo T several times, preparing for a month-long journey to Scotland, which we will follow up on.
Yeah, so this is our second time going to the British Isles, and this time we're going specifically to Scotland to do a stone circles tour investigation. And I'm really into stone circles, and especially the astronomy of stone circles and archaeology in general. But we're going to investigate and see what we can find out and discover about many of the stone circles in Scotland.
Beautiful. And you are working on documentary films. Do you have a name, a working title for that?
Yeah, so we're doing a film series, and the series title is Axis Mundi. And then we're doing several volumes, and we're editing the first volume now. And the title of the first volume is The Order of the Cosmos. We're hoping to have that out by next year. And then close behind that, we'll have volume two. Both of these first two volumes are going to cover the astronomy of Chaco Canyon in New Mexico. And then we're moving forward in production mode on the third volume, which will be about stone circles and possibly also mounds and earthworks will fit into that volume as well.
I can't wait to see it. I saw a little snippet before and it's amazing stuff. Chloe is, amongst other things, she's a moon aficionado. I have a moon calendar from you guys, and so if you're interested in a moon calendar, I can get you the information as to where to get a moon calendar from. Where would they?
Chloe, we have a website, and so our calendar from last year is already, you know, outdated, but we're working on the next calendar for next year. And she just put up on there so you can order the calendar for next year. And so, yeah, we'll have another calendar next year, and she could definitely speak better about the specifics of the calendar. It is a special calendar, unique, and kind of a creation that she created by just basically realizing she wanted to adapt her life more closely with the moon while still being able to utilize the Gregorian calendar. So
that's very interesting. Some nice photos too. What's the website, Chloe?
RetrogradeMotionPictures.com.
And that's where you find the calendar?
Yep. So, I just set it up so you can pre-order calendars for 2025.
Okay. Well, wonderful. You guys are going to have a great trip, and we'll find out.
Thank you. We find out. Appreciate it. Yeah.
We always love having you on Skywatcher Leo T.
It's a pleasure and honor to be on Skywatcher Leo T.
Thank you. Bon voyage.
Merci.
As it is one sky, many cultures throughout all of this and all of the episodes on Skywatcher Leo T. Let's take a minute and think about what Palestinian children and people see when they look up at the sky through the haze, dust, and debris. They may see an amazing array of constellations seen only from there. Shooting stars and planets. For that matter, what do the Israeli children and people of peace see? The sky is all of our heritage, everyone's. Look up, look around, get lost in space. Skywatcher Leo T.